And so God, as he always does, provides a mechanism for which they could obey him. And so God would travel in front of the people of Israel as a pillar of cloud during the day and as a pillar of fire at night. And that should have been comforting to the people. And then Exodus 13, 17 through 18 says, "When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle." And so so there's a short route to the promised land where God is taking them back to, but God recognizes that they would face some battles if they went that way. And even though that God would deliver them, right, he's delivered them all along the way, he recognized that they would be a faint of heart. And interestingly enough, as we've talked here multiple times about archaeology, archaeology has discovered a whole series of Philistine strong points or different places all along that route that existed in that day. So it just goes back to support the accuracy of the Bible, that in that time they would have faced some battles. So God takes the people of Israel out into the desert. So once again, it's for their own good, but they have some trouble recognizing that. And we're going to see a pattern that develops of some grumbling and complaining against God, even though God was watching out for the Israelites, and that he later there delivered them from Egyptian pursuit. And so Exodus 16, verses 2 and 3 says that in the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." So from what we talked about last week, remember that Pharaoh was driving the people of Israel, and they were really punishing them by slavery, working them super hard, trying to kill them off, and they were complaining and crying out to God, and God heard their cries, and now he's delivering them. And so he delivers them, he's taking them into the wilderness for their own good, and their response is to complain at Moses and Aaron, who was his brother Moses' spokesperson. And so they're instead of asking God for help, right, and turning to God, they complain and they grumble. And it's an unfortunate thing, but it's easy for me when I read these stories and I go through this to look at the people of Israel and say, how could they be such complainers? And then I recognize in my own life where I do those same things when challenges come up and I don't turn to God and ask for his help and his wisdom. So in Exodus 16, 11 through 15 tells us God's response. "And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. That evening quail came and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, 'What is it?' For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, 'It is the bread the Lord has given you to eat.'" So here they are in the desert. Moses and Aaron cry out to God, and then God provides. So he provides them something they didn't even have to work for. So every morning, God would provide them the sustenance for the day right there. And it was an object lesson to the people of Israel that God would provide for them all of their needs. Maybe not exactly what they want, when they want, but it was proof that God was in control and providing for them. And so it's part of the lesson that God has, is that he helps the helpless. And this all ties into where we're going today when we talk about the law, is that if we think we can help ourselves, oftentimes our temptation is to set aside our reliance upon God. And God wanted the people of Israel to learn to rely upon him. And it goes all the way back to the promise of the deliverer in Genesis 3:15, when Adam and Eve originally sinned, that they couldn't fix the problem that they had made. Only God could fix it. It was a simple lesson. And in Exodus 16, chapter 16, verse 4, in the second part, it says, "In this way I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. So part of what God was doing here was testing the people of Israel to see if they would learn to trust him and follow the instructions that he gave. And then Exodus 16:20 says, "However, some of them paid no attention to Moses, and they kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and it began to smell. So Moses was angry with them." And I missed a part there. So part of the instructions that Moses gave them is that in the morning they would collect up enough of the manna to just provide for their needs for that day. And he told them very clearly, don't take extra. Don't store up any for tomorrow. God will provide for every day. And so some people, in contravention to God's instructions through Moses and Aaron, took some extra. And when they kept it, it was the next morning, it was full of maggots and it had begun to smell. And Moses was angry, so frustrated, I'm sure, at this point. So he's thrust into a position where he has to rely upon God for everything. He's got 2.5 million people to lead, so he feels the weight of the responsibility that God has put on him. And he's given these people the instructions that God has laid before him, and then they ignore it. So that would be exceptionally frustrating, and he was angry. And so they keep going on, and it's just part of God's way to teach the people of Israel. And it's part of his way of showing the people of Israel that disobedience to his instructions has consequences. So in Exodus 17, verses 1, 2, 3, and 4, it says, "The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water to drink. Why do you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?' And then Moses cried out to the Lord, 'What am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me.'" And so we see the people of Israel are, and this, you know, this is not a long time period at this point, so they're failing to learn from mistakes of the past. So when they needed food, had they just prayed to God, reached out to God, he would have provided. But even in their grumbling, he provided for their need. So now they come to Rephidim in a place where they need water, and their response is not to turn to God and pray and ask for him to deliver them, but their response is to grumble and complain to Moses and Aaron, so much so that Moses is concerned that the people will stone him. And so so Moses prays to the Lord, and in Exodus 17:5-6, the Lord answers Moses and says, "Walking on ahead of the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hands the staff. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock and water will come out of it for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. And so if you've ever seen a artist rendition of this, you know, typically it looks like a little bit of water coming out of a rock, like out of a faucet. But in the reality, if you think to 2.5 million people, plus all their livestock, that the amount of water that would be necessary to take care of them, it would have been large. And in Psalm 105, verse 41 says that he opened the rock and water gushed out like a river. It flowed in the desert. And so it's just an example of God providing, even despite the fact that certainly we can see, and God would recognize the people of Israel didn't deserve his deliverance, right? But God had promised them that he would take care of them. So despite their grumbling, he provides, and he provides this giant river of water in the middle of the desert. So God is gracious, which is consistent with his nature and with the promises that he has made. And so so all of this, just like God had taken Moses into the desert to work as a shepherd for 40 years to prepare Moses, God is going to begin preparing the people of Israel. And so on your outline there, you see they're going to talk about the 10 rules. And this is some pretty significant stuff. And the 10 rules ties back to the 10 commandments. And so anyone want to volunteer how you view the 10 commandments? What is the purpose of the 10 commandments? Show you a need for God. That's exactly right. The thing is, most of the time when you ask that question, the answer will be, well, that's how we prove that we're going to be acceptable to God. It's rules for how we have to live our life. And those are not bad things necessarily, but we're going to talk in greater detail about why what Paul said is exactly the right answer. So God told Moses that he had a message for Israel. And God had set out that the people of Israel were going to be his people. Now, he chose the people of Israel to be his witnesses and his examples throughout the world. He could have chosen any people group. So he didn't choose the people of Israel because they were particularly special, because they were particularly holy. God chose them, however, to be his witnesses and his examples. But the people of Israel, we can see just from this, they're complaining about God's provision that they really don't understand who God is. And they're about to get a real lesson in who God is and the characteristics of God. And that starts in Exodus 19, verses 1 through 6. And it says, in the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, this is what you are to say to the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you are to speak to the Israelites. So this is really important. So God is saying, if you will do this, then I will do something for you. Quid pro quo is what we call that. So if you obey me, then I'm going to make you a great nation. You will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. But you have to do the things that I ask you to do. So from what we know right now, right, the people of Israel, they come out, they immediately start complaining about not having enough to eat. They complain about food. They don't rely upon God. And so so God's not tricking them here, but he's asking them, will you do what I ask you to do? And if you do, I will do these great things for you. And the people of Israel, so that's the proposition that God has given Moses to ask the people of Israel. And so what we find is that, so if we go to Exodus verses 19, or chapter 19, verse 8, it says, the people all responded together, we will do everything the Lord has said. So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. So the trick here is that the people of Israel still don't understand the character of God, right? So they, despite all the challenges they've had, just in 3 months, right? Because it said this was at the three-month mark after they left Egypt. So all they've really done that we can see is complain and threaten Moses with all their complaints. But now God says, if you'll just obey me, then I'll make you a great nation. And so they all, Moses throws this out there, and they all say, yeah, that sounds fantastic. We'll do it. But now they're going to get a real object lesson from God on what those things are. They've agreed to do what God asked them to do without knowing what his requirements are. Now we're going to find out what those requirements are. And so there's a little illustration that we'll use in this Bible study that kind of helps lead with where we're going here. Because we also have to understand that if they didn't obey what God was going to ask them to do, that there would be a punishment. And so there was this group of people standing by this river. And they were watching a young man jump in and was trying to swim across the river. And he got caught in a tough current in the middle of the river. And he was fighting and struggling. And no one on the shore was strong enough swimmer to go out and save the young man, except for one guy who was a really strong swimmer. And he just stood there and he watched as the young man continued to struggle. And then finally, in the middle of the river, the young man stops his struggle and the strong swimmer jumped in. He swam out, he grabbed him, and he brought him back to shore. And when he got back to shore, all the people there were like, well, why did you wait? Why didn't you go out and why didn't you save him faster? So they were challenging him. And his answer was that while he was still struggling to do something on his own, I couldn't save him. I couldn't go out and I couldn't bring him back. But when he finally quit struggling to do it on his own, that's when I could jump in and pull him back to safety. And so we're going to see that same thing play out when we talk about God and his rules and his instructions for us. That when we stop trying to do things on our own, then it is that God can provide for us. And so God's going to provide some visual aids on how this is going to play out for the people of Israel. And so he starts this in Exodus 19, verses 10 and 11. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day, because on that day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people." So step one in God's plan with the people here is that the people need to become consecrated or separated, right? Set aside for God's purposes. And so in order to do that, they have to be untouched by sin. They have to be clean and pure if they're going to stand before God. So we know that those are not all true things, but so in that kind of that literal sense, he wants them to shower and be prepared and be clean so that when God comes down on the third day at Mount Sinai, that they are prepared to see God. So he's teaching them about his character. And then in verse 12 it says, "Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, 'Be careful that you do not go up to the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death.'" And so God in that is demonstrating to the people of Israel, as there was all the way back with Adam and Eve with original sin, is that there is a separation between man and God. So God's perfect holiness versus man's sinful state. There is a separation there, and anyone who would touch the mountain in violation of God's rules would definitely die. So that was step two, that separation between man and God. Exodus 19, verses 16 through 19 says, "On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace. The whole mountain trembled violently, and the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. Then Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him." So can you imagine? So this is step three, is God demonstrating his power. So they've been told for 2 days to be clean, not to go step on the mountain, otherwise they would die. And then now God descends, and there's fire, and there's smoke, and the entire mountain is rumbling. I can only imagine that it was truly an awe-inspiring thing that they were observing, the power of God on display, and even then, just a tiny bit of it. And so they were being reminded by God of his power and their lack of power at this point in time. And so we're going to see then he's going to give the people of Israel now the instructions. He said, "If you will do what I ask you to do, I will make you a great nation," in essence, right? And they said yes already. So now he's going to tell them, he's going to give them 10 things that they have to do. And so we see in Exodus chapter 22 and 3, God spoke and he says, "I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me." So God is telling the people of Israel, the first thing that they must understand is that they must have no other gods before God. So he didn't want them to worship anyone else or anything else. And the reason given is very clear, and we can see that in Isaiah 45:5, when it says, "I am the Lord, and there is no other. Apart from me, there is no God." So God and God alone is to be everyone's God. Those who desire to be holy, to be accepted by the Creator, must worship only the Lord. And so so the question that brings before our mind is, what do we put before God? What do we consider important? Do we have any other gods that we worship before God? All right, verse 4 and 5, the first part of 5, give the second rule. He continues, "You shall not make for yourselves an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them." So rule number one, you will worship God and God only. The second command is to not worship an image or an idol of any god, whether true or false. And this God would have also included not to make any idols or anything, any figurines or anything that would represent God. Because then people can become twisted in the way they worship and the way they understand God. God's rule one, I am the only God, worship me only. Number two, no idols or any the form of anything on heaven or on earth below to worship. And Isaiah 42:8 says, I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another or my praise to idols. And so the first two rules have been laid down, and they're very clear, right? And so we have to also think, though, what are the things in our life that we do that we put before God? It could be hobbies, it could be work, it could be family sometimes even things that seem to be good. Maybe it's television shows, all those things that could really become an idol in our life that causes us to turn away from God and to put God in a place that's less important. So there's an implication there that we should be thinking through, and that the people of Israel, if they were really paying attention, would also be thinking through. Exodus 20, verse 7 gives us the third rule. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. So God is very direct about that his name is to be respected. His name is never to be used lightly, and it should be held in all reverence. And so we see that in day-to-day, right, in our current environment, that is super easy to use the Lord's name in vain. So you see OMG and all these other things that have become completely second nature to us, as if it's, we had this discussion with one of our kids that, well, it doesn't really mean that. Like, yeah, it really does. It's saying, it's using the Lord's name in vain, but it's become so minimized that we don't even think about it anymore, that we just say it without even recognizing that we are no longer holding God's name in a position of authority. And so rule number three is to be very clear, is that the God, his name and his title is worthy of our utmost honor, and that if we've ever used God's name as a swear word, then we have broken rule number three that God has given us. Rule number four is in 8, 9, and 10. It says, remember the Sabbath by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work. And so God was telling the people of Israel that they were to keep the seventh day, Saturday, in this case for the Sabbath, as a rest day. And that special day would show the rest of the world that God had established a distinct relationship with them. And so it was part of his covenant with Israel, and part of how he wanted them to demonstrate that they were his chosen people and that they were following his instructions. Exodus 31:13 said, say to the Israelites, you must observe my Sabbath. This will be a sign between me and you for generations to come, so you may know that I am the Lord who makes you holy. And so God is just reiterating to the people of Israel that they are his chosen people, and as a result of their special relationship, that he wants them to keep the Sabbath there, and that it's him and his authority and his power that makes them holy, not anything within their own strength. All right? Rule number five is in Exodus 20, verse 12, and it is, honor your father and your mother. So in this command, God is just telling children they should esteem their parents. And God is just reiterating in a very careful form that the normal family should be a place of peace and not hostility, and that children are to be respectful and obedient with their parents. And so that's part of the holiness that God demands of all people. So talking back, ignoring, arguing, pouting, the silent treatment, criticism, all those things are ways that children can sin against their parents and in violation of God's rule number five. Rule number six in Exodus 20, verse 13 is, you shall not murder. And so one of the important things is that God had given life to man, right? So he had breathed life into the nostrils of Adam to start. And so life was given by God. God is, he's the author of life, and he considers that important. And so, and this is one of those rules where it's easy for people to go, well, at least I haven't murdered anyone, right? So we're going to see that God looks beyond just the actions, though. He looks at the intentions of the heart. And it goes back to why something like the prayer request that Gloria had this morning is important to us. So that we can see, for example, in Hebrews 4, 12, and 13, it says that God judges the thoughts and the attitudes of the heart. Nothing in all creation is hidden from God's sight. Everything is uncovered and laid bare before the eyes of him to whom we must give account. So God doesn't just look upon our actions. He looks upon the intent of our heart and why we do the things that we do. He obviously sees beyond that. And then we see in Matthew 5:21-22, when Jesus was speaking, he said that you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. So to meet God's standard for not murdering, it means that we must not lose our temper or be angry without cause. So the standards that God is laying out for the people of Israel to meet are exceptionally high. Rule number 7 in Exodus 20:14, you shall not commit adultery. And so God is just saying that the only time for people to be intimate is within the marital relationship, and that once you're married, that relationship is to hold. And so you're never to be intimate outside of that relationship. But once again, God is not only looking at the actions, he's looking at the heart. And so Matthew 5:27-28, Jesus said, you have heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And so once again, the desire to look upon a woman that you're not married to, once again, God is saying that he is concerned about our heart and our minds, not just the actions that we take. And to meet his standard of holiness for the people of Israel, for us to be accepted by God, we can't violate that rule. Rule number 8 in Exodus 20:15 is you shall not steal. And so, obviously this one here is another one. God doesn't want us to take things that belong to others, the right of personal property, but we have to think beyond just, it's not a matter of coming in and taking something off a desk, but if we cheat on our taxes, if we cheat on a test, those are other ways or examples of how we can violate God's rule here that you shall not steal. Rule number 9 in Exodus 20:16, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. And so, once again, God in his character wants no part in deceitfulness, and he wants us to also have no part in deceitfulness. So anytime we would libel or gossip or slander another person, then we are in violation of God's command that we should not give false testimony against our neighbor. Truth is a very core part of God's character and who he is. And Titus 1:2 says that God who does not lie, and so it just talks the intricacies and the details, and Hebrews 6:8 says it is impossible for God to lie. It is just part of God's character that a lie, it's not possible for him to not tell the truth. And so the standard for holiness is that we be like that. And that's in contravention to Satan that we read about in the Bible, who's the father of lies. And the Bible tells us the very opposite of Satan is that he cannot tell the truth. He will mix in a little truth, but he always mixes in lies with that. And so the father of lies can tell no truth, and that's the difference in that character. So anytime we give false accusations, we are violating God's 9th rule. Then rule number 10, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant or his ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor, his car. I mean, it's still a pretty good list, although we don't have manservants or maidservants, but you can think of all those things that God is just basically saying that he wants us to be satisfied with the things that he has given us in our life, and that to covet or to want something that doesn't rightly belong to us is outside of the bounds of what God has as a standard for holiness. And so in our society, we bump the parameters of this law all the time, but it's that very subtle commercials and all those things that drive us to want other things that other people have. And so it's just being aware of our mindset and being very careful of that. And so so at this point now, God has given the people of Israel these 10 rules for them to understand. And so, they'd already agreed, sure, you tell us what you want and we're going to do it. And then you're going to make us this great nation. You're going to make us a nation of high priests and all these great things. And that sounded really good. And then they'd already made the agreement with God. And now God is saying, all right, so now here's the things that you have to do in order to be accepted by me. You have to do all of these things perfectly. So Romans 7:7 says, "Indeed, I would not have known what sin was except through the law, for I would not have known what coveting really was if the law had not said, 'Do not covet.'" So the people of Israel now know what they agreed to. Right? So they know what the God's standards are for holiness and for perfection. And so their eyes should be open at this point, right? And then the next question becomes, so when you get a list of rules, right, our next question is like, well, how strict are the rules? So if it says, I can't go over here, can I really not go over there? And that's, you know, human nature, as sign says, don't touch. You know, it's just everyone comes in like, really? And it's just, that's human nature, right? So the Israelites would have had that same thought in mind. Well, okay, so God's going to give us these rules, but just how strict is He on these Ten Commandments? And so Galatians 5:3 says, "Again, I declare to every man that he is obligated to obey the whole law." So we can't just get by with a part of the law, because some things in there might, in that list, might not seem all that difficult to us. If we're really honest with ourselves, it's pretty unlikely that anyone in here hasn't violated all of the rules. But, you know, maybe you just have a personality where you just have never cared about material things, and so coveting is just not your thing. So maybe not. But Galatians tells us that it's the whole law. And then James 2:10 takes it even further. James 2:10 says, "For whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles at just one point is guilty of breaking all of it." Wow. Okay, so I can't just walk up and touch it, right? Because now, if I just, or I can't just do one little tiny thing and then say, well, I'm actually really good though, right? I didn't do the other nine, so I just did. So I really liked the new car my neighbor had and I was coveting it. But that's it. In my whole life, that's the only thing I've done. So James 2:10 tells us that just that one thing has violated God's law, because He takes sin so seriously that it's just the same as having violated all of God's law. So it gives us a picture of how serious God considers this. And so if we want to be accepted as righteous and holy for God, then we have to meet His requirements. And so now the people of Israel know what those requirements are. So what about if I didn't know, right? So we have the same thing in our law here, and it comes from the Bible, crazily enough, right? So what if you don't know? Well, I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to covet my neighbor's new Lexus. So Leviticus 5:17. So, you know, in the law, so Leviticus is one of the books of the law. So where, you know, more rules were kind of put in place, some given by God, some from man. But Leviticus 5:17 says, "If a person sins and does what is forbidden in any of the Lord's commands, even though he does not know it, he is guilty and will be held responsible." And so that's the same standard that we have in our legal system here. But it came from God's standards, that even not knowing doesn't get us off the hook, right? So someone who's never, you know, never paid any attention to the Bible or never can't, won't be able to stand before God's like, "I didn't know." It's like, no, God said that's not good enough. We are all held accountable to His standards. And so an honest person at this point would be thinking, whoa, I'm in trouble. If righteousness and holiness are required for me to be accepted by God, I'm in deep trouble. Because there is truly no way that we can keep that list of rules perfectly. So that brings us back to the question for the purpose of the law and the answer that Paul gave us. So Romans 3:19 says, "Now we know that whatever the law says, it says, that every mouth may be stopped or silenced, and that all the world may become guilty or accountable before God." So the purpose of the law is not to give us a list of rules that we can follow. Although the world would be a much better place if we all made an attempt to follow those rules, right? But the purpose of the law was for us to understand that we were imperfect and that we're not holy and we're not righteous, right? And so when we recognize that, it stops our mouths. So we can't talk about how great we are, right? Because if we're honest with ourselves, we're not. We haven't met God's rules. And it says that all the world may become guilty or accountable before God. it defines for us God's standards so that we recognize our imperfections and therefore our need for God. And so the Ten Commandments shows us that we are indeed lawbreakers and that we are all guilty of breaking God's law. And so in a way, the Ten Commandments serves as a mirror. And Romans 3:20 says, "Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin." And so, the purpose of the ten laws was to make us, aware or conscious that we are sinners. And so, in a way, it's like a mirror. So, if I'm talking to Tim, I'm like, "Hey, Tim, you got a smudge there on your cheek. Looks like maple. Probably a donut this morning." Tim's like, "Nope, no, I don't. I don't have anything." I'm like, "No, really, right there." He's like, no, I just came out of the bathroom. I don't have anything on my face." So we can have that argument, right? But if I put a mirror up in front of Tim, all of a sudden Tim's like, "Oh, okay, yeah, there is something there." And so the law is that same way. You can say, "Tim, you're a sinner." He's like, "No, I'm not. I'm a good guy. I mean, I might not be as good as Kevin or someone else, but I'm better than John or Bill or someone," right? Because we always play that game too. Like, "Well, I may not be perfect, but I'm better than someone else I know." And so the law provides that mirror so we can argue about that. And then we say, "Well, but what about against these 10 rules? Have you ever done any of these things? Have you ever been angry with a brother? Have you ever been angry with someone that cut you off in traffic? Oh, well then God considers that equal to murder. So you are now no longer perfect under God's law." So the law serves as a mirror. And so keep in mind that a mirror is for reflecting, right? It reflects back on us the truth. It's not for cleaning. The mirror is not going to clean off Tim's face. And it's the same way with the law. The law is not going to clean us before God because we can't clean ourselves. We can't obey ourselves to perfection because we've already violated the law. As James 2:10 said, we have violated one part of the law, at least one part, and therefore God looks at it as if we've done it all. So we have a problem. The law is a mirror, shows us our faults, but now we have to figure out how do we get clean before God. So, and it's just like the same way, one other thing to add to that is that a mirror is a neutral object, right? So the law itself is also impartial. The law doesn't take sides. It is fixed and it doesn't change, just like the mirror. And so now let's turn to God's viewpoint. Romans 7:13 says, "Therefore did that which is good become a cause of death for me?" When it's talking about the law, it says, "Therefore that which is good, did that which is good become a cause of death for me? May it never be. Rather it was sin in order that it might be shown to be sin by affecting my death through that which is good, that through the commandment, sin might become utterly sinful." And that can be a little bit confusing there, but basically what's that saying is that, well, does the law then, because there's the law, does that mean that I'm guilty and that I'm going to die? So is the law a bad thing? And so Paul is saying there, not that Paul, the author of Romans is saying, no, the law is good because it demonstrates our need for God, right? It demonstrates how important it is that we resolve our sin with God. And so it's describing that gulf. So, up to this point, men could have, and, certainly happened all the time, and even after this point. So men could be prideful and say, once again, it goes back to that, I compare myself against someone else or some different standard, some human standard that I come up with. And so men can become prideful and say, well, I'm actually okay. I'm a good person. And God's standard is saying that that's not the case. And Psalm 51:5 says, "Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me." And so this goes back to the concept of when Adam sinned, that we became sinful by nature, right? So our entire nature was changed through the line of Adam, through the seed of the man. So even from the time we were conceived in our mother's womb, we have a sin nature. We are no longer acceptable to God as a result of sin in our lives. So we have a sin problem. And God's holiness is beyond our reach. It is unattainable. And so on the last part in your outline there, it talks about two groups. And so we can assume that there were two groups of people, and even today, two groups of people in Israel as they heard God give the give his commands to the people of Israel. And we have those same two groups today. We have group one who's focused on the externals. So they see all the thunder and the lightning and the clouds, and they're scared, but they keep on fighting a losing battle with the current. So they recognize that need, but they don't recognize their sinfulness. And so they continue to look at the externals, and they continue to think, well, I'm going to just be better. I'm going to go out, and I'm just going to keep trying to be a better person. I'm going to do more things. I'm going to go to church more often. I'm going to give more. I'm going to be nicer to my neighbors. And I'm going to try and earn favor with God. And so we all know people that try to do those types of things. And so group one looks at the externals. Group two is that looked at what Jesus said and said, wow, I'm in trouble because I could never meet those standards, and I've already failed to meet those standards. So what am I going to do? Group one are the people, they're the swimmer in the middle of the river that's still struggling and fighting, figuring out how they're going to take care of themselves. Group two is those of us who have quit and said, all right, God, I can't do this on my own. What do I need to do? Exodus 20:19 says, they said to Moses, and these are the people again, speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not have God speak to us or we will die. And so there's a big group of Israel that, like, okay, I'm afraid now. And so, like, Moses, can you just be our intermediary? And, I mean, you know, can you just imagine what that must have been like? You know, I heard a guy say one time that he couldn't wait to get heaven so he could just shake God's hand. And it just, it floored me because I thought, you know, no matter what it is. So in John, in the book of Revelation, it talks about John, one of Jesus' apostles. So I'm sure he was as close to being a really good guy from human standards as you could possibly get. And so he appears before God. And the very first thing he does is he falls flat on his face in front of God. And so that's the picture we're getting here. These people recognized, okay, there's something about this God. And whether they recognize their sinfulness or whether they just recognize the power of the externals, they recognize that there was something different. And so the people of Israel, they wanted Moses to be the intermediary. And then Exodus 24:12 says, the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and stay here, and I will give you tablets of stone with the law and the commands I have written for their instruction. And so now the Ten Commandments are in force. The people of Israel have a standard of accountability and a moral standard. And so the bottom line is that if they were going to be accepted by God now, if they were going to get the, if you'll do this, then I will do this, if they were going to get the, I will do this from God, they had to meet God's standards. And so I think the last thing on the outlines there, it talks about is the 10 suggestions. It says, just because the 10 commandments are unable to restore the broken relationship with God, it doesn't mean that they are without value, right? So they're a moral code, and I mentioned that earlier. So if everyone tried to live by the 10 commandments, you know, we would certainly, no one can make an argument, and in my mind's eye, at least logically, that an effort to live by the Ten Commandments wouldn't make the entire world a better place. If all the nations tried to do that, then it would be a better place. But the bottom line is that we are all incapable because of that sin nature and because of that separation, right, and our slavery to Satan, to sin, and to death that resulted from sin, that we are helpless. And so the question on the bottom there is, what kind of sinner are you? So most people will readily agree that they are sinners. Not all, but most. But very few will readily admit that they are helpless sinners. And there's a big difference. So once again, it goes back to that the analogy, the swimmer. Are you a helpless sinner where you've given up and you've turned to God like, God, what can I do to be reconciled to you? Or are you the sinner that's still struggling to try to earn acceptance by God? And Isaiah 64:6 tells us, when it comes to trying to work and earn God's favor, Isaiah 64:6 says, all of us have become like one who is unclean, and all of our righteous acts are like filthy rags. We all shrivel up like a leaf, and like the wind, our sins swept us away. And so that's a powerful verse, especially if you understand it in the Hebrew, is that it's saying all of our righteous acts are like filthy rags. So our attempts to do good, to be accepted by God, are totally meaningless to God. And in fact, filthy rags, that phrase there in the Hebrew, is the equivalent of like menstrual pads or types of things. Just to give you a figure of what that says, if you understand in the Hebrew. So it's saying that your attempts to be acceptable to me are completely disdainful to me as God. And so it just gives us a feel for, because God tries to tell us in the Bible, here's how you will be accepted by me. And then people reject that. And so it's just God's way of saying, you need to listen and do the things that I am telling you to do. So the question all of us is are we helpless sinners or the sinners that think that we can be accepted by God? And with that is the end of lesson 9. So on the back of your handout is some homework questions for next week. We'll kick off the start next week with those questions. So I recommend, the temptation is always to do them right now when everything is fresh, but I would encourage you to go back this week with the outline, go through all those verses, read through all that again, and then answer the questions as at some point later in the week, so that you can go back and just think on, because this is a pretty essential lesson to the whole building block of the Bible, and central to every aspect of our relationship with God, that need for us to recognize that there's nothing we can do to be accepted by God.